It was 6 days before the tusks could be pulled from the decomposing flesh, and by then Manyoro had assembled a gang of porters from the nearby Samburu villages to take them back to the base encampment on the Ewaso Ngiro River. On the return march, they made a detour to pick up the cached rhino head. The long file of porters were carrying an impressive array of big game trophies as they approached the camp. They were still several miles short of the river when they saw a small group of horsemen riding towards them from the direction of the camp.
"I bet this is my dad coming to find out what I've been doing."
Kermit was grinning in anticipation.
"I can't wait to see his face when he lays eyes on this lot."
While they reined in to wait for the approaching riders to come up, Leon brought up his binoculars and studied them.
"Hold on, that isn't your father."
He stared a few moments longer.
"It's that newspaper fellow and his cameraman. How the hell did they know where to find us?"
"I reckon they must have an informer in our camp. Apart from that, they have eyes like circling vultures,"
Kermit commented.
"They don't miss anything. Anyway, we can't avoid talking to them."
Andrew Fagan rode up and lifted his hat.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Roosevelt," he called. "Are those elephant tusks that your men are carrying? I had no idea they grew so large. Those are gigantic. You're having a wonderfully successful safari. I offer you my heartiest congratulations. May I have a closer look at your trophies?"
Leon called to the porters to lay down their burdens. Fagan dismounted and went to inspect them, exclaiming with amazement.
"I'd love to listen to your account of the hunt, Mr. Roosevelt," he said. "If you could spare me the time, and of course I'd be extremely grateful if you and Mr. Courtney would be good enough to pose for a couple more photographs. My readers would be fascinated to hear of your adventures. As you know, my articles are syndicated to almost every newspaper in the civilized world, from Moscow to Manhattan."
An hour later, Fagan and his cameraman had finished. Fagan had half-filled his notebook with shorthand scribbles, and his photographer had exposed several dozen flash plates of the hunters and their trophies. Fagan was eager to get back to his typewriter. He intended to send a galloper to the telegraph office in Nairobi with his copy and instructions that it was to be sent urgent rate to his editor in New York. As they all shook hands, Kermit unexpectedly asked Fagan,
"Have you met my father?"
"No, sir, I have not, though I must add that I am one of his most ardent admirers."
"Come to see me tomorrow at the main camp," Kermit told him. "I'll introduce you."
Fagan was flabbergasted by the invitation, and as he rode away, he was still calling his thanks.
"What came over you, chum?" Leon asked.
"I thought you hated the Fourth Estate."
"I do, but they're better as friends than enemies. One day, Fagan may be a useful man to know. Now he owes me a big marker."
Leon and Kermit rode into the main camp on the river in the late afternoon. Nobody was expecting them. With his robust constitution, the president had completely recovered from the effects of his Thanksgiving dinner. He was sitting under a tree outside his tent, reading his leather-bound copy of Dickens's The Pickwick Papers, one of his perennial favourites. With a bemused air, he regarded the uproar that his son's arrival had created. The entire personnel of the camp, almost 1,000 strong, was hastening from every direction to greet the returning hunters. They crowded around them, craning for a closer look at the tusks and the rhino head. Teddy Roosevelt laid aside his book, adjusted his steel-rimmed spectacles on his nose, stood up from his chair, tucked in his shirt over the bulge of his belly, and came to find the cause of the commotion. The crowd parted deferentially to allow him through. Kermit jumped from the saddle to greet his father. They shook hands warmly, and the president took his son's arm.
"Well, my boy, you've been away for almost 3 weeks. I was starting to worry about you. Now you better show your old man what you've brought home."
The two went to where the porters had laid out their bundles for inspection. Leon was still mounted and close enough to the president to have a clear view of his face over the heads of the crowd. He was able to watch every nuance of his expressions. He saw mild, indulgent interest give way to astonishment as Roosevelt counted the tusks lying on the ground. Then astonishment gave way to dismay as he took in the size of the ivory shafts. He dropped Kermit's arm and walked slowly down the line of trophies. His back was turned to his son, but Leon saw dismay harden to envy and outrage. He realized that for the president to have reached his position of utmost eminence, he must be one of the most competitive men on earth. He was accustomed to excelling in any endeavor and ranking first and foremost in any company. Now he was being forced to come to terms with the fact that for once he had been outshone by his son. The president stopped at the end of the line and stood with his hands clasped behind his back. He chewed the ends of his moustache and frowned heavily. Then his expression cleared and he was smiling as he turned to Kermit. Leon was filled with admiration for how swiftly he had controlled his emotions.
"Splendid," said Roosevelt. "These tusks beat anything we already have, and almost certainly anything we'll get before the end of the expedition."
He seized Kermit's hand again.
"I'm proud of you. Really and truly proud. How many shots did you have to make to get these extraordinary trophies?"
"You'd better ask my hunter that, Father."
Still clasping Kermit's right hand, the president looked at Leon.
"Well, Mr. Courtney, how many was it? 10, 20 or more? Tell us all, please."
"Your son killed the three bulls with 3 consecutive bullets," Leon replied. 3 perfect brain shots." Roosevelt stared into Kermit's face for a moment, then pulled him roughly into the circle of his muscular arms and embraced him fiercely.
"I'm proud of you, Kermit. I couldn't be prouder than I am at this moment."
Over the president's shoulder, Leon could see Kermit's face. It glowed. Now it was Leon's turn to suffer mixed emotions. He rejoiced for his friend, but for himself he felt tearing agony. "If only my father could bring himself to say that to me one day," he thought. "But I know he never will." The president broke the embrace at last and held Kermit at arm's length, beaming into his face with his head cocked on one side.
"I'll be damned if I haven't sired a champion," he said. "I want to hear all about it at dinner. But my nose detects that you need a bath before we eat. Go and get cleaned up now."
Then he looked across at Leon.
"I'd be pleased if you would join us for dinner as well, Mr. Courtney. Shall we say 7:30 for 8?
While Leon used his straight razor on the dark and dense stubble that covered his jaws, Ishmael filled the galvanized iron bath almost to the brim with hot water that smelled of wood smoke from the fire. When Leon stepped out of it, his body glowing pinkly, Ishmael had a large towel ready for him, which he had warmed beforehand at the fire. A set of crisply ironed khakis lay on Leon's bed, and beneath it stood a pair of mosquito boots, polished to a gloss. A short time later, his hair combed and pomaded, Leon set off towards the circus-sized mess tent. Determined not to be late for the president's dinner, he was half an hour early. As he passed Percy Phillips's tent, the familiar voice hailed him.
"Leon, come in here for a minute."
He stooped through the fly to find Percy sitting with a glass in his hand. He waved it to indicate the empty chair across the floor from where he sat.
"Take a pew. The president keeps a dry table. The strongest brew you'll be offered tonight is likely to be cranberry syrup."
He made a small mow of distaste and pointed at the bottle on the table beside Leon's chair.
"You better fortify yourself."
Leon poured himself 2 fingers of single malt and topped it up with river water that had been boiled, then cooled in a porous canvas water bag. He tasted it.
"Elixir. I could get addicted to this stuff."
"You can't afford it. Not yet, anyway."
Percy held out his own glass.
"You'd better refresh me while you're about it."
When his glass was recharged, he raised it to Leon.
"Mud in your eye," he said. "Up the rifles,"
Leon returned. They drank and savoured the fragrant liquor. Then Percy said,
"By the way, did I congratulate you on your recent spectacular successes?"
"I cannot recall you doing so, sir."
"Damn me, I could have sworn I did. I must be getting old."
His eyes twinkled. They were bright blue and clear in the wrinkled, sun-baked face.
"All right, then, listen well. I'm only going to say this once. You earned your spurs today. I'm damn proud of you."
"Thank you, sir. Leon was more deeply moved than he had expected to be.
"In future you can drop the sir and make it Percy."
"Thank you, sir."
"Percy. Just plain Percy."
"Thank you, plain Percy."
They drank in companionable silence for a while. Then Percy went on.
"I suppose you know I'll turn 65 next month."
"I'd never have thought it."
"The hell you wouldn't. You probably thought I was well over 90.
Leon opened his mouth to protest politely, but Percy waved him to silence.
"This is probably not the time to bring up the subject, but I feel myself slowing down. The old legs are not what they once were. Nowadays, every mile I walk feels like 5. 2 days ago, I clean missed a Tommy Buck at 100 yards, a dead sitter. I need some help around here. I was thinking of taking on a partner, a junior partner. In fact, a very junior partner."
Leon nodded cautiously, waiting to hear more.
Percy took the Silver Hunter watch from his pocket and snapped open the engraved lid, studied the dial, closed the lid, drained his glass and stood up.
"It would never do to keep the former President of the United States of America waiting for his dinner. He enjoys his food. Pity he doesn't feel the same way about wine. However, I've no doubt that we'll survive."
There were 10 for dinner in the big tent. Freddy, Saluz and Kermit had the seats of honour on each side of the President. Leon was placed at the foot of the table, in the chair furthest from his host. Teddy Roosevelt was a born raconteur. His tongue was silver, his knowledge encyclopedic, his intellect monumental, his enthusiasm infectious and his charm irresistible. He held the company spellbound as he carried them with him from one subject to another, from politics and religion to ornithology and philosophy, tropical medicine to African anthropology. Leon let the eland steak on his plate grow cold as he listened with rapt attention to the President evaluating the present international tensions in Europe. This was a subject that Penrod Ballantyne had expounded in great depth with his nephew as they had sat around the campfire on their pig-sticking forays into the felt, so it was familiar ground. Suddenly the President singled him out.
"What is your opinion, Mr. Courtney?"
Leon was dismayed as every head turned to him expectantly. His first instinct was to escape by replying that he had little interest in the subject and that he did not feel qualified to express an opinion. But then he rallied himself.
"Well, sir, you will excuse me for looking at this from a British point of view. I believe that the danger lies in the imperial aspirations of Germany and Austria. This, with the proliferation of exclusive treaties between numerous states that is now taking place across Europe. These alliances are complex, but they all make provision for mutual protection and support in the event of conflict with an outsider. That could trigger a domino effect if the junior partner in such an alliance blundered into confrontation with its neighbour and called upon its more powerful ally to intervene."
Roosevelt blinked. He had not expected such a weighty response.
"Examples, please," he snapped.
"We believe that the British Empire can only be held together by a powerful Royal Navy. Kaiser Wilhelm II has made no secret of his intention to build the German Navy into the most powerful force in the world. Our empire is threatened by this. We have been forced into concluding treaties with other nations in Europe, such as Belgium, France, and Serbia. Germany has treaties with Austria and Turkey, a Muslim nation. In 1905, when tension rose between Morocco and France, our new strategic partner, it precipitated a crisis across all of North Africa. Because of its alliance with Turkey, Germany was obliged to intervene against France. France is our ally. Therefore, we were obliged to intervene on her behalf. It was a chain effect. Only intense diplomatic negotiation and a mountain of luck averted war."
Leon saw the expressions on the faces of his audience turning to respect and was encouraged to continue. He made a deprecatory gesture.
"It seems to me that the world is teetering on the brink of the abyss. There are wheels within wheels, and countless threads in the web, as I know you, Mr. President, of all people, will be aware."
Roosevelt folded his arms across his chest.
"A wise head on young shoulders. You must dine with us again tomorrow evening. I would like your views on racial divisions and tensions in Africa.
But now to more important affairs. My son likes to hunt with you. He tells me that the two of you have made plans to build upon your recent triumphs with elephant and rhinoceros. I am delighted that Kermit wishes to continue hunting with me, sir. I enjoy his company immensely. What is your next quarry to be? My head tracker has discovered the lair of a very large crocodile. Would a specimen like that be of interest to the Smithsonian? By all means. But that shouldn't take too long, if you know where the crocs hold up. After that, what are your plans? Kermit wants to take a good lion. Cheeky young devil. He punched Kermit's shoulder playfully. Not content with beating me at Jumbo and Rhino, now you want to make it three in a row. The company laughed with him, and Teddy Roosevelt went on. Okay, buddy, you're on. Shall we have $10 on it? The two of them shook hands to seal the bet, and then the president said, If it's to be lions, we are fortunate to have the world's leading expert on the subject right here with us. He turned from his son to the handsome greybeard at his other side. Perhaps, Luz, you'd be good enough to give us some hints on how to go about it. In particular, I'm interested in hearing you talk about the warning signals a lion gives the hunter before it charges. Can you describe them for us and tell us what it's like to face such a charge? Sir Luz laid down his knife and fork. Colonel, I have the greatest respect and admiration for the lion. Apart from his regal bearing, his strength is such that he can carry the carcass of a bullock in his jaws as he leaps over the 6-foot fence of a cattle pen. His jaws are so formidable that they can crush the hardest bone as though it were chalk. He is swift as death. When he attacks, his first burst of speed covers the ground at 40 miles an hour. With his soft but authoritative voice, Salus kept them enthralled for almost an hour until the president interrupted him. Thank you. I want to make an early start tomorrow, so if you gentlemen will excuse me, I'm off to bed. Leon walked with Percy as they made their way back to their tents. I'm impressed, Leon, with your political acumen. Although I detected tones of your Uncle Penrod in what you had to say tonight, I think Teddy Roosevelt was also impressed. It seems to me that you've managed to set both feet securely on the ladder to the stars, just as long as you don't get his son bitten by a lion. Remember Frederick Saluza's advice. They're devilishly dangerous creatures. When the lion lays back his ears and flicks his tail straight up, it's the signal that he's going to charge, and you'd better be ready to shoot straight. They had reached Percy's tent. Good night, Percy said, stooped through the fly, and let the canvas flap drop.